understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show. I am joined by Euan Erasmus, a pastor in South Africa who holds degrees in both philosophy and theology and is currently doing his PhD on race and reconciliation. And Euan recently shared his fascinating story in this fab new book called Coming to Faith Through Dawkins. Euan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Ruth, no problem.
Now, what I love doing with people is going right back to the beginning. So I guess my first question to you would be, what was your experience of God growing up in South Africa?
Look, I mean, I reluctantly took part in the book. I really think, well, one, I'm careful of this testimony sensationalization. I often felt as if in church circles that the one who had the most sex and the most drugs and the most and came to Christ, you know, there was a higher hierarchy, so people were almost competing in terms of testimonies. So I reluctantly took part in this book, and it was a good exercise for me nonetheless. But my beginning of my Christian faith, I grew up in a very good Christian home, whatever that may mean. And in South Africa, in the Afrikaner community back then, it would have been very very conservative. And we grew up in a Reformed church, but faith was also pretty boring. It wasn't necessarily a very vibrant church. You know, there wasn't such a thing as Sunday school, apart from the church service. You had to sit there and just suck it up. So it's a little bit like I assume you guys feel about Anglican chapel services in your public schools or whatever. You know, there are lots of Monty Python skits about the trauma that that comes from chapel. So I guess that was my experience. But I was just surrounded by Christians, a lot of it cultural Christians, but a lot of it, I think, genuine as well. And then I think even though as a young kid, I was mostly occupied with things called, you know, like rugby and cricket and later on maybe girls. But that stopped abruptly when my father died of a heart attack. He was in his early 40s. I was, I think, 12. And from that day, like it just didn't satisfy me anymore to just play rugby and play cricket, run off the girls. I had bigger questions that I was wrestling with. And I mean, it's almost overnight that all these questions of where is my dad now? And how sure are we about that? And what about who made God? All of these things just came to me all at once. And what about the other religions? And what if we're wrong, et cetera, et cetera. And these were questions that I soon realized you didn't ask in this very conservative environment. And it wasn't malicious. Like I wasn't this victim, or, you know, these days everybody's talking about trauma and they had religious trauma. I didn't have religious trauma. But the questions I was asking was not the questions that the other, you know, the people in my environment were trying to answer. And, you know, I remember having these crises in the middle of the night, and to my poor mother's detriment, I would wake her up at 12 and just say, how do we know God exists? Who made God? And my mom, I mean, she's not the best apologist at any time of the day, but she's especially poor at 12 o'clock at night and in the mornings and when her 12-year-old boy is just bombarding her with questions like these. And then she would phone the minister, and he would earn his keep, and I would drive. I would be dropped off there and spend time till 3 a.m. talking about theology. And then somehow I didn't think about these things, but when I went to sleep and when I woke up, I was woken up with these questions. The way in which this particular pastor, and I mean, God bless his soul. He's wonderful people. I don't want to, you know, assassinate any characters or any traditions or whatever. But back then, the things that white Afrikaners were thinking about are black people and the black danger. You know, that's going to take over the country. Communism, the red danger. And then the only apologetics were actually geared against Catholics. So we were still fighting the Catholics of, you know, the 1500s. And there was very little geared towards questions of ultimate reality, like does this whole thing even exist? So I always said, my question is not how to believe. My question is whether to believe. And you guys are just talking about how to believe, you know, through Mary or the Pope, or and you guys say no, Scripture alone, and you guys say no, grace, whatever. That's not my question. I don't want to know how to believe. I want to know why to believe. And that question just never emerged in the circles that I found myself in. And it was a very lonely place. And I distinctly remember getting a little book that somehow ended up in our school library. It just said, "Does God exist?" Afrikaans. And I took it out and I said, "Oh wow, I didn't know that we were allowed to ask these questions." And as I was reading it in the library, one of my classmates just came running out. "Oh, what are you reading?" She grabs the book and says, "Oh, how dare you? How dare you read this?" I'm like, "Oh dear, like, I need to hide this like I would hide cigarettes." And that's what I did. You know, I started to hide my skepticism, and I realized that there were a lot of places that I couldn't necessarily voice it. So my earliest memories of Christianity and sort of moving over a little bit into skepticism, it wasn't through trauma, it wasn't through anything big. I mean, obviously my dad dying, I've read somewhere that most philosophers, they lost their dads at an early age. Now, I'm a useless philosopher, so I can't claim that it had a great effect on me, but at least it got me thinking, you know, about bigger questions. And you know, maybe in hindsight, I can see God's hand in that.
And one of the things that you mention in coming to faith through Dawkins is that I think it was an English teacher, you said, at school gave you a collection of C.S. Lewis's essays. Was that your first interaction with C.S. Lewis?
Oh, yeah. I remember it was... I can't remember because I don't have the book anymore, but I'm pretty sure it was God in the Docks. You know, it was sort of these one-liners. It wasn't sort of trying to tell a story or making a case for miracles or probably. So it was sort of a random attempt at, you know, explaining versions of Christianity. And she was a good friend of my mom, so she would often visit at home, and I just always listened to her, and she was very open about her faith. And I sort of ventured to voice my skepticism around her, and she was my English teacher as well. And then she was just so calm and unoffended by anything I asked, and she just gave me this C.S. Lewis book. She would later give me Tolstoy books as well, and was the other guy, Dostoevsky, and a lot of people that played a pivotal role in her conversion, but in a very soft, understated way. She never even spoke to me about the books. She would just sort of bring the books. And it's almost a little bit like a typical story or a movie protagonist, the sort of a Mr. Miyagi in Karate Kid. You know, this sort of this wise person from the outside just gently giving me books and allowing me to stumble and fall and learn. So that was my first interaction.
And what did you make of that book at the time? Because obviously you were quite young.
Yeah, so this was early high school. I'm not the brightest guy in the world, and I'm not the brightest Afrikaans guy in the world. So a C.S. Lewis book in high school, it didn't necessarily just leap off the page. I had to work a little bit to get it. I've got other friends, and in primary school, they read The Problem of Pain. It was no problem. I hate those people because, you know, that's not me. I struggled through these things. But I remember there was a guy talking about myth and the fact that the Bible is not like that. And just as a literary historian and a literary theorist, he would say, look, this is not it. And he would make a case for it. And I remember just thinking, this is it. And whenever I had a chance to talk about Christians, I would just sort of have this one trick of saying, yeah, I remember C.S. Lewis said this and C.S. Lewis said that. And I held on to that with everything in me. But it was a flimsy faith. You know, there wasn't much or any Bible reading for that matter, but my little God in the docks, I think, that traveled with me. So on the one hand, I didn't necessarily probe and ask, did he write anything else? So maybe I wasn't as hungry as I think I was. On the other hand, that was the only little bit of information that I had about faith that seemed to make sense.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. You went on to study theology. How was your experience studying theology, Yuan?
So I went on with the intention of studying theology. And then I went to this faculty, and you must think of something out of the 80s and 70s. You've got these old men in their gray and brown suits, and they sit there, and it's very intimidating. And you go sit there as a first year, and they ask you, why do you want to study theology? And I said, I want to know if it's the truth. And these people are swallowing tongues, and it's this horrible, awkward silence. And eventually, the one guy managed to spit it out, and he just said, "Brother, you do not study theology to get faith. You have faith, and then you study theology." And I was sitting there, and they were looking at me, and I was looking at them. They were looking at me, and I was looking at them. And then we all agreed that I'm in the wrong place, which is kind of bizarre. You would think a bunch of theological professors would sort of jump at the opportunity to disciple a guy a little bit. But I guess they were just trying to ensure that if they help fund this student to go through 6 years of theology, they're not wasting their money. And maybe they were red flags all over me. And then I went to philosophy and you know, the humanities, because those guys aren't very picky, so they take anything they can get.
It's so bizarre, because I had completely the opposite experience. I think often studying in England, and particularly I think at Oxford and Cambridge or some of the sort of older universities, I was one of
stop,
the only
stop Christians. Bragging.
But I was one of the only Christians studying theology. It was completely the opposite thing, in that actually you were almost penalised for being a Christian and studying theology, because it was very much seen as an academic discipline as opposed to a kind of personal devotional thing.
It's changed, to be fair, and not necessarily for the better. So although I don't think the situation that I'm describing is ideal, it has changed. So that you've got a lot of skeptics and a lot of your sort of typical, I would say, progressive ideologies has emerged, and queer theology and all of that is all over the place. And it's very weird to see sort of the last remnants of this old guard and these guys infiltrating, trying to stand in the last standoff, so to speak.
Yuan, there's a really interesting quote that I'm quoting from you that you say in the book, where you say it was social suicide to confess your skepticism in the wider Afrikaner community back then. I mean, how did that make you feel? Did you just feel completely isolated, that you were the only person kind of having these questions, having these doubts?
Yeah, I think I thought I was exceptional. And that is a mistake. I do not want to sound patronizing, but I think it is a mistake that most skeptics make, is they think they're exceptional in their skepticism, in the thoughts that they have, especially coming from a Christian background. If you if you sit in church and you've got these questions and you do not necessarily feel the comfort to voice them, and they sort of harbor inside of you, then you think, oh man, nobody has ever thought about these things that I'm thinking about. And it's only when I mean, we'll get to that in a bit, but it's only when I started asking those questions, I realized, oh man, I am such an idiot. And at the sort of right at the end of this procession of the intellectual Christian tradition. But I can tell you that to this day, I've got a big heart for skeptics, especially skeptics in a Christian environment. And I'm talking about Christian environments that's not necessarily the healthy type. So think of the American Bible Belt. I can assume, I've never been there, but I can assume that there can be unhealthy versions of that. And if somebody tries to think outside of the box or they question their faith, it can be a little bit difficult there. And in our Africana little subculture, that was very much the case. And to this day, you know, when I listen to people who come out of religious homes, but they are mostly skeptical, my first response is always one of sympathy, because I know it's lonely.
Well, you then discovered the New Atheist, so I assume you then were like, oh, I'm not the only person who has got these questions, who's sort of had these ideas. And I guess in some ways it kind of helped you articulate some of your growing skepticism. Was there particular elements that appealed to you about their writing, some of the things that they were saying, the way that they were saying it?
I said it earlier that we had these guys fighting each other within the Christian faith. The charismatics were angry at the reformed guys for not having the spirit. The reformed guys were angry at the charismatics for not being, I don't know, chosen. The Catholics were also enemy number one for both the charismatics and the reformed guys. So that's what I saw. And those weren't my questions. And then when I pick up the Hitchens and the Harrises, now I'm seeing guys sort of dealing with the questions that I want to deal with, although I didn't really deal with them. It was more of a just saying, don't wait for Christianity to provide any answers. That was sort of more of their message. But they were at least trying to address the questions that I struggled with. And something else that happened that was, and this might offend one or two listeners, and again, I'm not trying to be offensive, but I briefly, in my first year, discovered young earth creationism, and especially a guy called Kent Hovind. So I'm sure there are better versions of it, and then there are bad versions of it. And for the first time, this guy seemed to answer my questions. At least he's like being evidential, saying, oh, yeah, this really happened. Here are my arguments. And he just gave an account of the science. And I, for the first time, I understood, which is always a red flag, by the way. If I understand science, then you need to know that there's something dodgy going on. And so I understood. Everything made sense all of a sudden. And it lasted a week or two or three. And then people just said, dude, this is going to not stand against scientific scrutiny. And it was Christians and skeptics alike who just said, no, man, there's no way you can say this in public or even think it. So after that, I thought, well, that was the best version of the Christian apologetic. I didn't know the word back then that I could find. So maybe there is maybe there's nothing there. And I guess I became a little bit more content with what the atheists around me were saying. And I guess, you know, it's difficult to recollect these things because the memory is deceiving, and one doesn't want to lie and whatnot. But I remember being angry at the New Atheists for being right. Like, I was angry that I agreed with them. And I experienced a sense of loss now that I'm sort of finally going to walk away from this Christian heritage, which is all I've known. So maybe that's my one-liner. Should have put it in the book, actually, the second edition, maybe. I was angry at the New Atheists at first for being right. At least that's how I experienced them.
And one of the things that I think really struck me was that it was conversations with a friend of yours who had been studying theology in the States, and she came back, and you were having conversations with her, I guess, throwing some of these ideas that you had got from The New Atheist. Would you just say a little bit about those conversations? Because they were quite a significant turning point for you.
Such a pivotal moment, yeah. So this friend, I mean, she studied here in South Africa, and she went to London and worked there, I think, as a teacher, and then went to the States, and she studied philosophy and theology, but with a very strong focus on apologetics. And I think she studied under Norman Geisler, who's one of the apologists. And you know, make of him what you want, but she was well versed in sort of mainstream apologetics. And I went to her, and she, and I asked her, "So what are you doing now?" I thought she was still teaching in London. She said, "No, she's studying theology." I'm like, "Ooh, okay." And I remember she was a smart girl in school. She was really smart. So I thought, "Ah, okay. Well, have you read these guys, the Hitchens, the Harrises, the Dawkins?" And usually that didn't mean anything to anybody in the circles I moved, but she recognized those names. And then she said, very disappointingly, "Johan, you really need to get yourself some better atheists." I'm like, "What?" So what do you mean? She said, "Well, look, I've got no problem with you being a skeptic, and I've got no problem about you losing your faith and whatnot, but have some self-respect. If you lose your faith, at least read the likes of Michael Ruse or Thomas Nagel or John Gray or the like. But if you're going to give it up this easily, I'm going to be offended." And I'm like, "What?" I didn't expect it. So she was not only telling me that she knows my atheist, but she was advising me to read better atheists than these atheists. And then I said, okay, well, maybe that's just a cute rhetorical trick. So who made God? Boom. You know, that's the knockdown question. Who made God? You know, are you going to have like infinite causality and it doesn't make sense? You know, blah, blah, blah. And then she just went on and said, "Oh, okay. I mean, we've been thinking about this at least until the at least from the Middle Ages, probably before that." And she starts articulating Thomas Aquinas and the fact that if time began at creation, then God does not exist inside that realm. And she just went on a little bit, and I thought, okay, well, I didn't expect that. And then I threw some of the problem of evil stuff and sort of the conflict between science and faith, and that it's irreconcilable and whatnot. And then, I mean, I can't remember the details, but she just went very on. She said, "Well, there are a couple of scientists that's going to disagree with you." And I remember she mentioned Alistair McGrath's name. I didn't know anything about him, but subsequently I've handed action with his literature. And she just said, "Well, this biologist, John Polkinghorne, is also going to take great exception with what you just said, Johan." And she's just mentioning, like, name dropping all of these Christian scientists who are both committed Christians and committed scientists. I guess I didn't know that. And it just lasted hours and hours and hours into that night. I just refused to go to sleep. I would often like go make a coffee and say, no, we're not done. Get up. And I just couldn't stop. It was like drinking out of a hose pipe, and I just refused to close it. And that was a very fateful encounter with my old friend Cornelia.
Well, I suppose compared to some of the kind of shutting down of those questions that you'd experienced previously, it must have been so refreshing to have someone not only, you know, say these questions are valid, but actually really begin to engage with you on those questions and provide some answers that you didn't even think were possible.
So I think the juxtaposition, you're right, is what made it such a fascinating encounter. Is that, and I knew she took her faith seriously from early days. So I knew, I'm gonna probe a little bit more and see how she reacts to this. By then, I didn't really worry anymore, you know, how people respond. So, and then she didn't dismiss the atheist objections. I remember just giving her some version of the problem of evil. You know, if God is all powerful and if he's all loving, then he would want to rid the world of evil, and he would be able to rid the world of evil. So why is there evil? I think they attributed to Epicurean or Epicurus or someone. And then, I mean, I can't remember how she formulated it. She said, I think we can make that even stronger. She said, if God is a God of love, and he and she brings in other attributes, and she just makes the point stronger. I'm like, yeah, okay, let's go with that one. That's what I wanted to
let's
say.
Have your objection.
Yeah, that's mine. Yeah. Good luck answering that thing that you just, you know, bitted on. And then she just went on and says, well, this is the problem with it. And then she says, well, Alvin Plantinga had pretty much solved this thing. What? So it was the complete opposite of everything that I've experienced before that. It was this environment, not only in which it was encouraged to be skeptical, but I had to be a better skeptic than I was. So she wanted the best out of my skepticism so she could answer that. So very bizarre and meaningful encounter.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.